just remember this. A kiss is still a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by.
Vietnam, and good timely greeting to you, dear listener. Welcome back to another exciting episode of Play It Again, Kyla, a podcast within which I seek to answer the questions, is a kiss still a kiss? Is a sigh just a sigh? Do the fundamental things in fact apply? Now, up until this point here at Play It Again, Kyla, every episode I've dealt with a specific film. That film has been the title of the episode, and the discussion has proceeded as it pertains to that film specifically. But as this podcast has ballooned and grown, I've been wrestling with how best I can create a new format within the show that allows me to discuss my love for film in a more general context. And I've arrived at the conclusion that the best way to do that is to every so often allow myself to do special episodes. And for now, I plan to have those special episodes proceed like this. So as you may or may not have noticed, we just passed our 40th episode marker here at Play It Again, Kyla. And in order to celebrate 40 episodes, I decided to give you four top 10 lists. So I plan to have these top 10 lists in the future each time we pass a new 10 episode marker. And basically how they're going to play out is the subjects of the list. I've already planned quite a few of them. I haven't actually gone through and written down my answers to each list, but I plan to do a top 10 list of uses of songs in a film. Top 10 lists for top 10 craziest skills an actor has acquired for a role. Top 10 films from a given year, top 10 performances from a given actor, top 10 best on-screen couples, top 10 DVDs with best bonus features, and so on and so forth. I figure I should start with a very general, broad top 10 list for this first installment. So the four lists I'm going to give you today are my top 10 favorite actors, my top 10 favorite film soundtracks, my top 10 favorite pairings of actors, and my top 10 directors. I felt like it was important to give you guys a sense of who I am as a person and a film viewer, also because not every episode gives you a sense of my viewing habits and my preferences. There's a lot of episodes that I've really wanted to do that I haven't been able to do yet because I haven't been able to find people who are willing to discuss those films with me. My taste is not exactly identical to that of my friends and family and to the people that I have access with during this time of social, the people that I have access to during this time of social distancing. I say this with a little bit of humor, but I am somewhat of a pretentious film viewer, and so sometimes it's hard for me to find people that want to discuss the films I want to discuss. That's not to say I haven't loved doing all the episodes I've done up until this point. I absolutely have, and I'm also, you know, a fun film goer at times too. Like, I love Spice World more than anything. I think that it needs to be preserved in the National Film Registry. I love doing an episode on Scooby-Doo 2 Monsters Unleashed. So I'm not a joyless film viewer. I do enjoy very serious films a lot of the time, and sometimes obscure films. And so I just wanted to give you guys a view of more of a view of the totality of myself as a film goer. Now I feel like I've set this up and you're going to be expecting me to like bust out some super pretentious, serious answers here, but some of these answers are just fun. If you are a frequent listener of the show, then you're not going to be surprised at all by my breakdown of favorite actors, at least not by the top few. But I guess let's just go ahead and dive in, shall we? So my top 10 list of favorite actors. So I'm going to give you, I'm going to go through, we're going to start with 10, build our way up to one, and each actor, I'll talk a little bit about like my exposure to them and my favorite performance of theirs. So let's start with number 10, my 10th favorite actor of all time. And I'm going to use actor here as a non-gender specific term, because I think that calling them actresses, I don't necessarily have a problem with it, but I prefer the umbrella term actor. I don't necessarily think that we should break down best acting categories on the basis of gender at award shows. I think that an actor is an actor, regardless of their gender, and their skill should be gauged and weighed out and rewarded on the basis of the merit of the performance and not just strictly being compared to people of the same gender. Anyways, that was a rant I didn't intend to get into here with you today, but this is just perfectly stream of consciousness. This is undiluted Kyla coming at you here in this very special episode. I have no guest here to tone me down. I considered having Hagen or Sarah, two of my most frequently recurring guests, beyond just to kind of keep me on track here, but maybe for future top 10 episodes I will do that, but for this one it's me all on my lonesome. So this is Kyla without a filter here. So my 10th favorite actor of all time, I have written down Ewan McGregor. When I was about 7 or 8 years old, if you had asked me who my favorite actor was, I would have replied with Ewan McGregor. He's the first person that I can ever remember referring to as my favorite actor. That is because of the Star Wars prequels. I loved him as Obi-Wan Kenobi. Obi-Wan Kenobi was my favorite Star Wars character for a really long time. Everyone, I'm sure, is gasping in shock because everyone now knows my favorite Star Wars character is definitively Padme Amidala. But it was Obi-Wan Kenobi for a very long time. And my first favorite Star Wars character was Leia. And then it became Obi-Wan Kenobi. And now it's Padme Amidala. It's been Padme for at least 10 years now, so I don't see that changing anytime in the near future, though I do love a lot of Star Wars characters. But I really loved Ewan McGregor's portrayal of Obi-Wan Kenobi. I had a big crush on Ewan McGregor as a young girl. I thought that he was just so sophisticated and charming and charismatic and not at all bad to look at. And so I really, really loved him. And then as I've grown, you know, I've been able to appreciate other entries into his filmography, like Moulin Rouge, Big Fish, which is a film that I don't really love. I maybe shouldn't admit that on the podcast, but I saw it for the first time probably when I was about like 9. And what's hilarious is I was in the thick of my Ewan McGregor obsession, and not even that was enough to make me enjoy Big Fish. So sorry if you're a huge Big Fish fan. Maybe I should revisit it, but every time I've tried to revisit it since, it just makes me cringe for some reason. We had a family viewing of it when I was about 9, and my dad really wanted us to watch it, and none of us enjoyed it, except maybe my dad. He wanted us to watch it because it was filmed around his hometown, and he wanted to be able to recognize all the sights in it, but none of the rest of us enjoyed it. Anyways, neither here nor there. Big Fish, though. No, I'm not a big fan of Big Fish. Sorry to those of you who are, but I love him in Beauty and the Beast. I love him in so many entries in his filmography. He doesn't really have that many bad films. I like his versatility. I think that he's pretty versatile as a performer. My favorite performance of his, other than Obi-Wan Kenobi, because I'm not going to allow myself to give that as a response because it's just completely biased. But my favorite performance of his is actually his performance in Jane Got a Gun. And I'm not just saying that because it's a Natalie Portman film. I genuinely love watching Ewan McGregor play the villain. I think he's fairly menacing as the villain in that film. He made me scared of him. And I was like 18 when that movie came out, so movies don't really scare me. And I mean, it's not like I was actually hiding, you know, behind my hands watching it or anything. But he was menacing enough. He was scary enough. I love the mustache. I love the way his eyes pop in that role. Love the entire look of that character. It's obviously very enjoyable for me to see him going toe-to-toe with Natalie Portman in that movie. But it's just so rare to me that I get to see Ewan McGregor play a truly bad guy. And so I really enjoyed the opportunity to watch him as a bad guy. So number 10 is Ewan McGregor, and my favorite performance of his currently is from Jane Got a Gun. Number 9 is Miss Audrey Hepburn it kind of pains me to put Audrey Hepburn that low. For the longest time, I said she was my third favorite actress of all time. That has changed, obviously, because she's here at number 9. And she's not the third actress listed. There are a few more actresses ahead of her now. That's not to disregard her place in the cinema canon. I think Audrey Hepburn is a force with which to be reckoned. She's phenomenal. I think I've seen every film in her filmography. That can't be said for every person on this list. Can't be said for Mr. McGregor. I'm sorry, Ewan, I'll get there eventually. But I've seen every single Audrey Hepburn film, most of them multiple times. And she just holds me enraptured every single time, no matter who she is playing. Not every entry into her filmography is great, but she is great in every entry in her filmography. And obviously she's got some very iconic roles, you know, Holly Golightly, Eliza Doolittle, Princess Anne from Roman Holiday. But my favorite performance from her is actually from Wait Until Dark. It's a film that I saw for the first time later in my Audrey Hepburn obsession. Listeners to the, like, returning listeners probably have heard me talk before about how I went through a big Audrey Hepburn phase, and that's when I watched every film in her filmography. And Wait Until Dark was one that I came across later in that obsession. I think the first film I ever saw in its entirety with Audrey Hepburn was Roman Holiday, which I feel like is a fitting way to be introduced to her. And then I kind of stumbled my way through. I didn't watch necessarily in order, but when I got to Wait Until Dark, I was just very, very struck by the power of her performance. And I really like thrillers. I'm not a huge horror fan, but I'm a big psychological thriller fan. And I just thought that Audrey Hepburn absolutely knocks it out of the park in this film. She, if you haven't seen it, go watch it. I try to watch it every year around Halloween. It's a film I really like to return to. It's got Alan Arkin in it and Mel Ferrer, so it's got a pretty good cast. And Audrey Hepburn, just as the blind heroine, pun intended heroine, there is a heroine, not female hero, but heroine as in the narcotic, also in this film. But I can't stress enough. It's a film that's hard to describe to those who haven't seen it. And I have no idea how many of you that are listening have seen it. But if you haven't, you should absolutely go watch it. I think it might not be Audrey Hepburn's greatest performance, but it's the performance I automatically associate with her most strongly. So Wait Until Dark, Audrey Hepburn, number 9, the performance I have noted as my favorite performance from her is Wait Until Dark. Number 8 is Val Kilmer. So after Ewan McGregor, my response shifted when anyone asked me who my favorite actor was to Mr. Kilmer. And I still, if you were to just ask me randomly who's your favorite actor, and I knew that you meant male actor, I would probably still respond with Val Kilmer, even though there are actors who rank ahead of him on this official top 10 list. I have a soft spot for him. I love him in so many things. I think he's criminally underrated, which it's hard to say that because he enjoyed quite a bit of popularity at the height of his fame, but he's still criminally underrated. The way he can just disappear into roles, the way he throws his physicality into all of his roles is something I'm always very impressed by. And my favorite performance of his is his performance as Doc Holliday in Tombstone. That's actually my favorite performance by any male actor of all time. It barely edges out some other very impressive performances for me, but that is my definitive favorite performance by a male actor. He is Doc Holliday. Anytime I think of Doc Holliday, I think of Val Kilmer's portrayal of him. The physicality, the irreverence of the humor and the wit of that character, it can't be topped for me. if you listen to my Tombstone episode, then you know how much I love that movie for a while there. From probably ages 11 to 13 or 14, I would refer to Tombstone as my favorite movie. Maybe not for quite that long, maybe like 11 to like 12 or 13 would be more accurate, because I think Garden State became my favorite movie around age 13. Anyways, not important. But Val Kilmer just, he inhabits the characters that he plays. He doesn't imitate. He doesn't even merely embody. He inhabits. And for that reason, he's one of my favorite actors of all time. And I have him listed here at number 8. And I have his performance in Tombstone as my favorite performance by him. Coming in at number 7, we have Runit Elkabetz. She was an Israeli actress. She tragically died very young. And I think often about what her contributions to Israeli cinema would have been had she have lived longer. She and her brother Shlomi Elkabetz, they directed as a team quite a few of my favorite Israeli movies. They made a trilogy of sorts that I just absolutely adore. I think they're some of the strongest entries into the Israeli cinematic canon. And she acted as the main character in that trilogy and just blew it out of the water. I first encountered Runit Elkabetz in a course I took at GW. It was actually the Arab-Israeli conflict was the title of the course, and we had to watch a few films as part of the course material, and one of the films was The Band's Visit, and she was just so disarming in her role in that film, and I was just transfixed, and I really enjoyed her in that role. And so then the following semester I took a course called Israeli Cinema, and I got exposed to a lot of the great films of the Israeli cinematic canon. And the film I enjoyed the most in that class was a film that she and her brother co-directed and that she starred in. It's part of that trilogy that I was speaking about, and it's called Git, The Trial of Vivian Amsalam. And that is one of my favorite performances by any actress ever. She absolutely is just astounding in that role, just as she is in The Band's Visit and just as she is in many of her performances. And so I really encourage you, if you've never seen any film starring Runit Elkabetz, you absolutely should look up her filmography and just watch any of them, because she's great in all of them. I really, really, truly am just so sorry for myself and for the world at large that she is not contributing to the Israeli cinematic canon anymore. Her brother Shlomi still is, and he's putting out some really good stuff still. But she was a force with which to be reckoned. She was a powerhouse. And yeah, I'm really sad that she's no longer with us. But absolutely, you should look into her filmography and watch some movies starring her. You should definitely watch Git, and you should definitely watch The Band's Visit. So at number 7, Runit Elkabetz, and I wrote two performances down for her, Git, The Trial of Vivian Amsalam, and The Band's Visit. Coming in at number 6, I have none other than Mr. Al Pacino. I don't know what to say. I could sit here and extol the virtues of Al Pacino as an actor until I'm blue in the face and until you don't want to listen anymore. So, I mean, I don't know what else can be said about him that hasn't already been said. I'm constantly in awe of him. I love him in so many of his films, and I hate to be extremely basic, but I truly think that his greatest performance is in The Godfather. I love him in Heat. If you listen to my Heat episode, you've heard me talk about his performance in that film quite a bit, but The Godfather just takes the cake. There's a reason, that is the basic response, as I called it, because it's the correct response, I have to say. So Al Pacino at number 6, and his greatest performance, in my view, is his performance in The Godfather. And speaking of The Godfather, coming in at number 5, I have Marlon Brando. Just like Pacino, I feel like people have extolled the greatness of Marlon Brando so often, and for good reason. There's a, like with Pacino, there's a reason he's considered the best, and he is the best. I'm not gonna say The Godfather for him because I said it for Pacino, even though I do love him in The Godfather. I'm gonna go for Brando with A Streetcar Named Desire. That's actually the first Marlon Brando film I ever saw. I saw it my freshman year of high school. I know, kind of sad that I made it that far in life without seeing any Brando pictures, but my freshman year in high school, in a drama class that I had, fourth block, so my final block of the day, one day we watched A Streetcar Named Desire. And I gotta say, because I was watching it with a bunch of other young teenagers in a classroom setting, I didn't fully appreciate the film, but I appreciated Brando and I appreciated Vivien Leigh. I was very moved by both of their performances. And having rewatched it many times since, I just think that I have to refer to that as my favorite Marlon Brando role, probably primarily for sentimental reasons, because it's the first Marlon Brando role I ever saw, because I could point to any of Brando's roles and be like, those are his best roles, because he gave his best almost every single time. So, but at number five, Marlon Brando, A Streetcar Named Desire. And speaking of A Streetcar Named Desire and Vivien Leigh, coming in at number four, Vivien Leigh. I promised that when I made this list, I didn't go from Pacino to Brando because of The Godfather, and then from Brando to Leigh because of A Streetcar Named Desire. I actually just wrote down all my favorite actors and then decided which ones absolutely had to be the top 10 and then in what order that the top 10 should fall, and then went back later and added my favorite performances because I like mulled that over for a while. And so it's just kind of funny that those three ended up in a little stretch together. Anyways, Vivien Leigh, again, what can be said about her that hasn't already been said? There's a reason she's pointed to as one of the greatest leading ladies of the golden age of Hollywood, because she truly was. She carried some of the best pictures of all time pretty much on her back. I often get in debates with my good friend Aaron about who's better, Vivien Leigh or Olivia de Havilland. And obviously for me, Olivia de Havilland manages to edge out Vivien Leigh in that race, but the fact that I'm willing to entertain debate on the topic should let you know how great Vivien Leigh is, because she really is right there with Olivia, who obviously holds a very special place in my heart and in my mind in terms of acting ability. And Vivien Leigh, just, she's a lot of people who are very close to me, she is their favorite actress of all time. And she's the third highest ranking actress on this list. She's phenomenal. She, again, a powerhouse, again, a force with which to be reckoned. We have yet to see another Vivien Leigh, and I don't think that we ever will see another Vivien Leigh. I think she was a once in existence talent, not even once in a lifetime, once throughout the course of human existence talent was what Vivien Leigh was. And again, it's a basic response, but I have to go with Gone with the Wind as her greatest performance, because I believe it's the greatest film ever made. It's not my favorite, but it's the greatest, and she pretty much carried it on her back. I'm thinking specifically right now about a special on, I believe, like the 70th anniversary DVD release. I'm not sure, but on one of the Blu-ray releases of the film, they did a special where Olivia de Havilland recalled like memories of filming, and she talked about how she had rapped, you know, a few weeks prior, and Clark Gable had rapped and Leslie Howard had rapped, and she came by for a few pickup shots, and Vivien Leigh had been there working every single day in the weeks that had transpired since everyone else had rapped, because she was in almost every single scene. Scarlett is in almost every single scene in that film. And so Vivien Leigh had to be there for the filming of almost every single scene. And that Vivien Leigh was just gaunt. Like, she had lost so much weight because she was working so hard, because she wanted to rap, because she wanted to go home to Laurence Olivier. But that worked very well for the character of Scarlett O'Hara, because the scenes they were filming at the time were the scenes where Tara has just been completely ravaged by the Civil War, and Scarlett is working her fingers to the bone trying to revive Tara. And so when I think of Vivien Leigh, that's what I think of, is that she literally gave her all to Gone with the Wind. And it's kind of funny and ironic that she was giving her all to it so that she could be done with it. But still, the fact remains that she threw herself body, mind, and soul into that picture. And I think that's one of the reasons it's the greatest films of all time, because you have stars of the quality of Vivien Leigh, of Clark Gable, of Leslie Howard, of Olivia de Havilland. And I could keep going. Like, even the supporting cast is so great. And I think they all gave their all to that picture. I know Selznick did. I know George Cukor did for the time he was employed. I know Victor Fleming did. So, yeah, Vivien Leigh coming in at number four and Gone with the Wind is what I consider her greatest performance. At number three, I have Mr. Daniel Day-Lewis. So Daniel Day-Lewis, if I said earlier, if you just ask me completely randomly who my favorite actor is, I'll probably respond with Val Kilmer. But if I have time to think about it, I'll usually say Daniel Day-Lewis, because I do think he's the most talented actor alive today. I mean, he's so method, which is admirable. I mean, whatever acting style you prefer, you have to admit that the fact that the man didn't shower at all during filming of The Crucible and built John Proctor's home with his own hands to get in character, like, that's pretty ridiculous. That's pretty admirable. Like, I got to give the man props. And then when you think about the fact that he met his wife while filming that film and he hadn't showered in weeks, probably by the time he met her, like, that's just really interesting to me. I would love to know more details about that, about what her initial impressions were with this man who no doubt smelled not great when they first met. Anyways, that's getting a little bit off topic. But Daniel Day-Lewis, I mean, there's a reason the man has as many Best Actor statuettes as he does. I'm constantly in awe of his commitment to his roles. Again, he's one of those who just completely inhabits whoever he's playing. My favorite performance of his, or what I consider to be his best performance, is Lincoln. Maybe not the typical answer, or maybe not the answer you expected, but I really, really love Lincoln. If you're keeping a timeline, which you're definitely not because no one cares that much, but if you're keeping a timeline of all the films that I've ever pointed to and said that's my favorite film, Lincoln, when it first came out, for a couple months there, I was like, that's my favorite film. It was quickly replaced by Garden State, if I can remember correctly. But I was very moved by Lincoln. I'm a huge, huge history buff, and Abraham Lincoln is one of my three favorite historical figures of all time. Four favorite historical figures of all time. Those historical figures are Lincoln, Anne Boleyn, Martin Luther, and Jacqueline Bouvier Kennedy Onassis. And so watching Daniel Day-Lewis just inhabit Abraham Lincoln was so exciting for me. My sister made fun of me because I pretty much just quaked in the theater. I enjoyed it so much. And she roasted me appropriately afterwards, as did everyone else who had gone with us to the theater to see that movie. Daniel Day-Lewis is the most talented actor that is alive today. So I hope to see him in more films. I know that he doesn't necessarily hope to be in more films, but I feel like he has more to offer us. I really do. So I hope that Daniel Day-Lewis, even though he claims to be retired, I think he's got another Oscar in him. So I would like to see more from him. And then coming in at number two, absolutely no one is shocked. It's Miss Olivia de Havilland. Olivia de Havilland has been my second favorite actress for probably about 8 years now. I was lucky enough to see a screening of Gone with the Wind in Tallahassee, Florida. My mom and I drove like an hour, 15 minutes to go see it. And I had seen Gone with the Wind many times. I grew up in a Gone with the Wind family. My middle name is Ashley because of Ashley Wilkes. And yet I felt like I saw Gone with the Wind for the first time on that big screen. And so and the reason that it was such a moving experience and the reason it felt like I was seeing it for the first time was because I was admiring Olivia de Havilland for the first time in all of her glory. Like I had never been struck by the character of Melanie before until that screening. And so I came out of that screening and I was talking to my mom about how much I enjoyed the performance of the actress who played Melanie. And I was like, hey, is Olivia de Havilland still alive? And my mom was like, I don't know. I don't think so. I don't think anyone from Gone with the Wind is still alive. And I looked it up, and sure enough, Olivia de Havilland was still alive at that point, obviously. At the time of recording, she has just passed away a few days ago. And I'm very, very sad about it. But also, it's really hard to be sad about a life so beautifully and fully lived. And so, mainly, I'm happy that Olivia de Havilland lived the life that she did and that she gave us the performances that she did. She has a quote that I've always really loved. I'm paraphrasing, but she basically said, no director ever got a performance out of me. I gave them the performance. And I think that was upon having been asked, like, who the most talented director she had worked with was or something to that effect. And I love that response because Olivia de Havilland, it doesn't matter what film it is, who the director is, who her co-stars are, she gave the same caliber performance all of the time. And that's something I really respect about her. I could list so many amazing performances from her. It kind of bothers me a little bit when people restrict her to, they call her the Gone with the Wind actress. And I'm like, yes, you know, Gone with the Wind, I consider it to be the greatest film ever made. So obviously everyone who worked on it is going to be associated with it, especially her because she was the last surviving cast member from it. But her filmography is so rife with so many phenomenal performances. To just pin her down as the Gone with the Wind actress just feels very restrictive and borderline insulting to her. My two favorite performances from Olivia de Havilland are The Snake Pit and The Heiress. She won the Oscar for The Heiress. I believe she was nominated for The Snake Pit. She did not win for The Snake Pit, but she was nominated quite a few times and didn't win, and that's fine. I don't accept the Academy as the end-all be-all recognition for best talent, but she does have two Academy Awards, so obviously they didn't get it wrong every single time. They got it right at least twice. But The Snake Pit is just, oh, it's so good. So such a phenomenal performance. If you haven't seen it, go watch it right now. Watch The Snake Pit and then watch Wait Until Dark. And then The Heiress has one of my favorite endings to any film of all time. And it's Olivia de Havilland that gives that ending all of its oomph. She's just great in it. I also didn't write this one down, but I'm just now thinking about it. Lady in a Cage is also a really good one. It's a good little scary thriller. It's got James Caan's first ever professional performance or major film performance in it. So my suggestion to you, dear listener, if you haven't seen these films, make a movie night out of The Snake Pit, Lady in a Cage, and Wait Until Dark, because I feel like they all could go together really well. I think that's my next movie night. I think I just have talked myself into that to make a trilogy of those of sorts. And my number one actor, to absolutely no one's shock or surprise, is Miss Natalie Portman. I'm not going to talk about her for very long because you can refer to any episode about a film that she stars in and hear me just gush uncontrollably, but she will always be my favorite actress of all time because she has such a raw, innate talent and has managed to marry that raw, innate talent to a very studious, very stringent professional approach that still manages to come across as completely natural. And so I'm constantly in awe of her. And my personal favorite performance by Natalie Portman, and what I consider to be her best performance, is her performance in 2009's The Other Woman. Black Swan and Jackie are givens. Everyone knows that those are great performances, but no one talks about her performance in The Other Woman. And I think it's her best. So if you haven't watched that one, you definitely should watch it. And you should check out my other episodes where I talk about Natalie Portman, because in the interest of time, I'm not going to do it all here. But if you ever want to hit me up, I will be glad to gush to you for hours about why Natalie Portman is the most talented actor to ever live. That's a very strong statement, but I made it and I'm going to stand by it. Okay. So those are my top 10 actors. Now I'm going to move into top 10 film soundtracks. When I was talking about Olivia de Havilland, I think I said that my mom and I drove like an hour. I'm pretty sure Tallahassee is actually like 2 hours. So geography is not my strong suit. I'm really great at most academic subjects, but geography has never been my favorite. So yeah, pretty sure it took us almost 2 hours to go to that screening of Gone with the Wind. Anyways, just wanted to clarify that point because it's been hounding me in the back of my brain since I said it. All right, moving on to film soundtracks. So I tried not to think about scoring at all, like not to think about scores in terms of like instrumentals specifically written for the film. But I'm going to do a favorite scores list at some point. But I didn't do a great job of separating soundtrack from score here, because there are a couple entries into this list that the score is definitely influencing its ranking a little bit. So sorry. I tried, but I did not succeed in that regard. But this is supposedly just a listing of soundtracks. And I'll explain the ones that there's one in particular that I'll mention when I get there, the scoring. I ranked it just according to the soundtrack, but it also has a great score. So anyways, number 10 in my favorite film soundtrack list is Ferris Bueller's Day Off. Ferris Bueller's Day Off is my favorite John Hughes movie. I really, really love Ferris Bueller's Day Off. It's one of my favorite movies just from the 80s in general. And it has such a good soundtrack. So that's coming in at number 10. All of these soundtracks also basically are soundtracks that I just will listen to at any given time. Like, I don't skip them if they come on shuffle on my Apple Music. And so I'll gladly listen to Ferris Bueller's Day Off soundtrack most any day of the week. So that's coming in at number 10. At number 9, I have Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? That was a big family movie in my household. It's also on TV a lot, so we watched it a lot, but it's one movie that like pretty much everyone in my family enjoys. So that's another reason we watched it a lot. And it has a really, really good soundtrack. I mean, Man of Constant Sorrow, so many good ones. I'll Fly Away. Emily Betts, if you're listening to this, I love you. And every time I think of I'll Fly Away, I think of you. And every time I think of you, I think of I'll Fly Away. Emily is one of my best friends. And in high school, I would drive her home most days after school. And she would ask for the aux cord. And she's the only person I've ever known who would ask for the aux cord and then play I'll Fly Away. She also would play like a bunch of really other random videos that were hilarious. But I'll Fly Away has always stuck in my brain that a like 14, 15 year old girl would ask for the aux to play I'll Fly Away. So that's the impact of Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, guys. So Oh Brother, Where Art Thou comes in at number 9. At number 8, I have the Guardians of the Galaxy soundtrack. I just recently did, you know, a Guardians of the Galaxy episode here on the show, and we talked a good deal about the soundtrack in that episode. And any soundtrack that has Moon Age Daydream by David Bowie is automatically on my list of favorites, because I love that song. But then the fact that it also has like Hooked on a Feeling, I Want You Back, Escape, Ooh Child, Ain't No Mountain High Enough. Like, I could go on. There's still more to be mentioned. Those are all some of my favorite songs though. And so Guardians has such a good soundtrack. Coming in at number 7, probably primarily for sentimental reasons, but also because it's just a banger of a soundtrack, I have The Little Mermaid. The Little Mermaid is my favorite Disney movie, and it's my favorite animated movie of all time. I thought I was Ariel as a little girl, and I wanted to sing like Ariel so badly. I love every single song on that soundtrack. I think it's the best Disney soundtrack of all time, and I think that Part of Your World is the greatest Disney song of all time, and that's a hill on which I'm prepared to die. it's better than any other Disney song that you're thinking of to try to come at me and argue that it's better than Part of Your World. I'm sorry, it's not. It's just not better than Part of Your World. Part of Your World reigns supreme in the land of Disney songs. And yeah, I don't think that I would ever just willingly skip any song from the Little Mermaid soundtrack. So it's holding steady at number 7. Number 6, I have the Vox Lux soundtrack. This is the one that I thought that I had to mention and have my little disclaimer about score versus soundtrack, because Scott Walker's score for this film is just, there are not words. I love it. I listen to it a lot. But the soundtrack, particularly the Sia songs that Sia wrote for this film, that's what I'm trying to rank it based on here in terms of soundtrack. So it's not score, but I can't talk about these Sia songs enough. They're so haunting. They're so good at being seemingly mindless pop songs that aren't actually mindless at all, that are songs that are constructed to get you to think about the nature of pop music and whether or not these lyrics actually are meaningless, or whether or not, because of the fact that we mull them over in our brains and in our souls so often, like, do they actually have to inherently mean something to us? And Wrapped Up, it's probably on my top 25 most played songs of all time. I love EKG. Like, I unironically listen to the soundtrack. It's not even a joke at this point. At first, it was somewhat of a joke, but, like, these songs have all grown on me. And so they're so good. They don't seem good at first, but that's the genius of Brady Corbet and of Sia, is that the film and the soundtrack both just stay with you. You can't shake them. And I think that's the point. So at number 6, the Vox Lux soundtrack. At number 5, American Graffiti. Just, it's so good. There's a reason. I'm pretty sure it's like triple platinum or something like that, for good reason. Absolutely. Because there's so many good songs used in that movie. George Lucas, you're a genius in every regard. I can't get over just how many good songs are shoved into this one soundtrack. And so it's, again, this one's holding steady at number 5, the American Graffiti soundtrack. At number 4, I have the Dirty Dancing soundtrack. I love the Dirty Dancing soundtrack. It's one of my favorite vinyl records that I own, in terms of movie soundtracks. She's Like the Wind, Hungry Eyes, I've Had the Time of My Life. And those are the ones that I think of first, because those are the ones I listen to the most. But there are other gems on that soundtrack also. It's so good. At number 3, I have the Perks of Being a Wallflower soundtrack. I don't know that this one would have ranked quite as high. It definitely would have been on the list, and it definitely would have been fairly high. But I recently took a trip to Pittsburgh and visited the filming locations of the Perks of Being a Wallflower. And my friend Sarah and I just put the soundtrack of this film on shuffle. And I don't know that I had ever listened to the entirety of the soundtrack until that trip, and I was so struck by how much I enjoyed a lot of songs on that soundtrack that aren't, you know, obviously we all think of Come On Eileen, obviously we all think of Heroes by David Bowie. I've really, really gotten into Pearly Do Drops Drop, so thank you Sam/Emma Watson for that. Asleep is a great one, but all of the songs on that soundtrack are great. And so I really enjoyed listening to it on repeat on that trip. And it's climbed up to number 3 on my list of favorite soundtracks. At number 2, I have The Graduate. I love The Graduate. I love Mike Nichols. You'll hear more on him in just a few minutes when we get to favorite directors. But come on. Simon and Garfunkel, Mrs. Robinson, that alone is enough for it to rank this highly. Like, it truly is. I love that song so much. I love Simon and Garfunkel so much. Garfunkel more than Simon. Sorry, Sarah, it had to be said. And then, you know, also on the soundtrack, you have The Sound of Silence. You have April Come She Will. Like, there are so many great songs. Thank you, Paul Simon, for this great contribution just to pop culture in general. I can't imagine The Graduate without this specific soundtrack. And so I love it, and it's holding steady at number two. And the number one greatest film soundtrack of all time, in my opinion, has got to be Garden State. You're probably not surprised, since I've already mentioned Garden State as a film multiple times in this episode and talked about how it was my favorite film for such a substantial amount of time. But it absolutely is the greatest film soundtrack of all time to me. I mean, it won a Grammy. It is my favorite film soundtrack that I own on vinyl. I love it. I love the letter from Zach Braff that's like on this vinyl sleeve. I'm pretty sure it's got like doodles. Like, it says like Sam Enlarged Forever and like a heart and like different things like that. It's one of my prized possessions, that vinyl. But the soundtrack, I never skip a single song from it when they come on shuffle. I listen to the soundtrack all the time. Don't Panic, Caring is Creepy, New Slang, Lebanese Blonde, Only Living Boy in New York, Such Great Heights. And honestly, I think my favorite is Let Go. I listen to Let Go all the time. So thank you, Zach Braff, and thank you, Garden State. It's the greatest film soundtrack of all time. Also, it introduced me to The Shins, and now The Shins are one of my favorite bands of all time. I know I'm being extremely like pretentious alt girl, like, look at me, I listen to The Shins. That's not how I'm trying to be at all. I mean, I found them through Zach Braff, so like, how cool can I actually be? I'm not. But Shoots Too Narrow is one of my favorite albums of all time now, so thank you Zach Braff for giving me that gift of introducing me to The Shins. So I have a sticker on my laptop. It's you gotta hear this one song. It'll change your life, I swear. And it's probably the sticker I get asked about the most, which is really saying a lot, because I have some really weird stickers on my laptop. Some great conversation starters. But I love that that's the one I get asked about the most. And when they're like, what song is it? I'm like, oh, it's New Slang by The Shins. Like, sorry, it's a Garden State quote. Sorry to disappoint. But no, Garden State. Greatest film soundtrack of all time. Nothing will ever change my mind on that. Sorry. So now my next list is my top 10 pairings of actors. So for this, basically, I thought about actors who have acted together in more than one picture. And so I've got the list, and I've got my favorite film that those actors appeared in. I tried to do it based on my favorite, not my favorite film, but my favorite of their performances opposite one another. So I'll explain why I chose the films I did. But so coming in at number 10, I have Johnny Depp and Helena Bonham Carter. I felt like I couldn't really make this list without including them. I'm not like particularly emotionally tied to them as a film pairing, but they've been in so many films together that I felt like they deserved a mention. And I think that their greatest film that they've made together is Sweeney Todd. For a split second, I actually considered putting down Alice in Wonderland, because I really enjoyed the live action Alice in Wonderland film. I believe it came out in like 2010, and I saw it with, my children's church group, a church group. We like went and saw it in theaters together, and I enjoyed it. I haven't watched it that many times since, probably only like two or three times, but I really enjoyed that theater going experience. So I considered putting that one, but I mean, come on, Sweeney Todd is actually their best. Let's be honest. So that's why that one ultimately won out. At number 9, I have the pairing of Saoirse Ronan and Timothée Chalamet. They're still up and coming. I feel like we have quite a few films in the future that we'll be able to see with their pairing. But for me, I think already they've made their mark. The fact that we associate them with one another so strongly is very telling, and proves that they, you know, are a formidable pair. And I put Lady Bird. I really went back and forth over whether, you know, it should be Little Women or Lady Bird, but I like their dynamic in Lady Bird more, I think. I mean, so I, that's why Lady Bird won out for me. I like Saoirse Ronan, putting him kind of in his place as a jerk in Lady Bird a lot. So I also, I like Timothée Chalamet a lot. I do. Sarah, you might want to turn your ears off at this point, but I don't, I'm not insanely crazy about him in Little Women, and I blame that on Sarah entirely. So for those listeners who are aware of my friend Sarah, who has been a multi-appearance guest here at Play It Again, Kyla, she is obsessed with Timothée Chalamet, and because of her, I've watched a lot of his filmography, and because of her, I've watched a lot of interviews with him, and I think it might just be because Little Women was the first Timothée Chalamet movie I watched post-seeing Statistics. Which, if you haven't seen Statistics, look it up. YouTube, Statistics, Timothée Chalamet. It's a rap music video he made for a Statistics project when he was in high school. And I just couldn't take him seriously in Little Women. I felt like in a lot of scenes that he came across as very just like Timothée Chalamet instead of like Timothée Chalamet playing a character, which, you know, is a strange complaint to make because you want your actors to seem natural, but it didn't seem like he was natural. As Laurie, it felt like he was natural as Timothée Chalamet to me. So for that reason, Lady Bird edges out Little Women. Sorry, Sarah, and sorry, Timothée Chalamet. I still think you're a great actor. I just, something about the timing of me seeing Little Women just, it didn't do it for me. Next, at number 8, I have the pairing of Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan. And my favorite film that they've made together, or what I consider the best film of their pairing, is You've Got Mail. You're probably not very surprised if you're a listener to this podcast because I've done an episode on You've Got Mail. You know, I like them in Sleepless in Seattle. I like them in Joe vs. the Volcano, but You've Got Mail is the one I return to the most. I pretty much want to watch that movie every autumn, if not more often than that. So I got to go with it. It holds a special place in my heart. I like them being antagonistic towards each other and also in love with each other the whole time, and they don't realize it. I just love the dynamic in You've Got Mail. So that's my favorite Tom Hanks and Meg Ryan picture. Then at number 7, I have Natalie Portman and Jude Law. So this one is a very interesting one to consider because they have made 4 films together, I believe. I'm pretty sure I'm right. They made Cold Mountain, Closer, My Blueberry Nights, and Vox Lux. But the only film within which they like actually are love interest or like play opposite each other in any sort of like romantic capacity is Closer. Now, Vox Lux, it could be argued because it's alluded to that their characters sleep together in that film, but they're not your typical romantic foils to one another. He's her manager and she's a pop star. He may or may not be the devil. We'll very interested to have Vox Lux episode in the near future because I have a lot to say about that movie. But anyways, so Closer is the only movie where they actually like definitively are playing one another's love interests. But I think that my favorite pairing of them on screen is Cold Mountain, which is interesting because I don't really like Cold Mountain. I think that it's not a great movie in a lot of ways. It has a phenomenal cast. It had some good performances, but like the movie as a whole is just a little bit of a mess. And what's really interesting is that Anthony Minghella in the commentary of that film refers to the scenes at Sarah's cabin, which are the scenes between Natalie Portman and Jude Law. He has referred to those scenes in that commentary as being representative of the film he actually wanted to make. Like, he felt like artistically and creatively speaking, the scenes between Natalie Portman and Jude Law were closest to what his actual, like, artistic and creative vision for the entirety of the film were. I would love to see what Anthony Minghella actually wanted Cold Mountain to be, because those are my favorite scenes in the movie. And I think that they just play off of one another beautifully. It's some of Natalie Portman's best acting in her career is in Cold Mountain. So it pains me that the rest of the movie is not great. But yeah, so Natalie Portman and Jude Law, their scenes in Cold Mountain are my favorite examples of them acting opposite one another. Then at number six, I have Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio. I love them. One of my favorite celebrity friendships of all time. And I really enjoy them both in Titanic and in Revolutionary Road. I think that maybe they do much more serious acting in Revolutionary Road, but in my heart of hearts, I've got to go with Titanic because I love Titanic. I really cannot put into words to you just how much I enjoy the film Titanic. It's my friendship movie with one of my best friends, Joe. We watch it together about once a month. And I remarked to Sarah the other day that I'm pretty sure, thanks to social distancing, this is the longest period of time I've ever gone without watching Titanic, because I haven't watched it in its entirety since the last time Joe and I watched it together, which I think would have been in February. So I've seen Titanic way too many times, way more times than any person ever probably should. And I love the chemistry between Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio in it. So Titanic is my favorite example of their pairing. So at number six, Kate Winslet and Leonardo DiCaprio, Titanic is the film that I've written as their best pairing. Then at number five, I have Ethan Hawke and Julie Delpy. If you haven't seen the three films that they made together, it's a Richard Linklater trilogy, and it's so good. I actually just watched all three films recently for the first time. By recently, I mean probably about 3 or 4 months ago now for a class I was taking. I was taking a capstone course called Is Love Really Such a Good Thing? And it's we only had to watch Before Midnight, but I ended up watching all three films because I enjoyed Before Midnight so much. So the trilogy is Before Sunrise, Before Sunset, Before Midnight. If you haven't seen it, you absolutely should. Some of Ethan Hawke's best work, some of Julie Delpy's best work. They're both very talented actors, and the pairing just, it's so good. And I think that Before Midnight is my favorite of their pairings, in terms of, because, so they made, obviously, as Richard Linklater often does, these films are, you know, spread out. So Before Sunrise came out in 1995, Before Sunset in 2004, and Before Midnight in 2013. So at this point, Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke had, you know, known each other for quite some time and had acted opposite one another, you know, for two other films previously. And so their chemistry and their dynamic in Before Midnight is something truly, truly special. So I really, really enjoy their pairing, and I really enjoy it specifically in Before Midnight. So that's number five. At number four, I mean, what list of famous pairings is complete without Bogey and Bacall? So I've got them at number four, Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. And in terms of, I feel like I don't need to really talk about their pairing because it's so iconic. And that can be said for pretty much all the pairings from here on out. But my favorite, I wrote down To Have and Have Not and The Big Sleep. To Have and Have Not, I mean, it's iconic. Obviously, it's where we get the famous whistle line, which I have to admit, I think I was first exposed to thanks to Pretty Little Liars when Spencer and Toby recreated it. I feel very embarrassed to admit that publicly, but I felt that it needed to be said. But I enjoy that movie for so many reasons. I mean, it's loosely based on an Ernest Hemingway novel. William Faulkner worked on the screenplay. So it's a perfect concoction of everything that Kyla likes. I mean, classic cinema, Bogey and Bacall, William Faulkner, Ernest Hemingway. But I also really, really enjoy The Big Sleep. I just am a big fan of, like, the mystery genre in general. And so film noir is really something I really, really enjoy. And so I had to mention both of them. I couldn't just mention To Have and Have Not. I had to throw The Big Sleep in there also. And then at number three, I have the pairing of Vivien Leigh and Laurence Olivier. I mean, like Bogey and Bacall, what can be said that hasn't already been said? They, you know, one of the most electric pairings in real life of all time between two actors, and also, you know, very electric on screen too. And I think my favorite film starring the two of them, and I think my favorite example of the two of them acting opposite one another, honestly is Fire Over England. I don't really know why. I've just always really enjoyed that movie. Maybe because TCM played it often enough for me to like see it enough times to feel like I really appreciated it. I don't know. But Vivien Leigh and Laurence Olivier, Fire Over England, holding steady at number three. At number two, so my second favorite pairing of actors that have worked together multiple times, it's Julia Roberts and Richard Gere. If they had worked together more than two times, they probably would be number one, just because their chemistry is so electric, so palpable, so powerful. They're just so good opposite one another. Sadly, to date, they've only been in two films together, in Pretty Woman and Runaway Bride, and I gotta give it to Pretty Woman. Like, it's the film I wrote down here is their best. Pretty Woman, it's up there for me in terms of, like, most enjoyable films. It's a film I return to a lot. I think it's my mom's favorite movie. Don't know if she would openly admit that, but I'm pretty sure it is. And, you know, it's the first example of that electric chemistry of that. I mean, they are lightning in a bottle together, and the lightning strikes most powerfully, I think, in Pretty Woman. So, yeah, I can't think of a couple that has better on-screen chemistry than the two of them. And then coming in at number one, it's Olivia de Havilland and Errol Flynn. Again, sorry if you're scoffing and you're just like, all of these are rigged. Olivia de Havilland's always going to rank near the top. But, I mean, you can't contest the fact that Olivia de Havilland and Errol Flynn, again, like Roberts and Gere, have some of the best on-screen chemistry of all time. Roberts and Gere's chemistry might be a little bit more scorching, but de Havilland and Flynn edge them out because they starred in so many pictures together. I believe it was nine total films, and every single one of them are just phenomenal. Now, obviously, Private Life of Elizabeth and Essex, they don't interact all that much, so, but the films that they do interact and act opposite one another are just so, so special. The Adventures of Robin Hood, obviously, is probably their most iconic pairing, either that or Captain Blood. My personal favorite in terms of the one I watch the most is Santa Fe Trail. I really enjoy Santa Fe Trail. I really enjoy Dodge City also. But the one that I wrote down as the best example of their pairing is They Died With Their Boots On. That was the final film that they made together. And it just, you can feel the fact that, like, in the goodbye scene between General Custer and his wife in that film, that was like a real goodbye between Olivia de Havilland and Errol Flynn, because they had spent, you know, a decade at least working together and making all of these films opposite one another, and just spending all of this time together and being in love with one another, but never at the same time. You know, Olivia de Havilland had a crush on Errol Flynn early in their working partnership, but he was married at the time, and so obviously she never pursued it. And then later on, he had a crush on her, but she was on to other things. And so it's terribly tragic and terribly romantic that, you know, they had love for one another in their hearts, but never actually were able to pursue it because the timing was never right. And so They Died With Their Boots On is just so bittersweet, because it's the culmination of that decade of working opposite one another. And so that scene where they say goodbye to one another, I think, is one of the most powerful scenes ever put on film, because, like I said, it's not just goodbye between husband and wife. It's goodbye between Olivia de Havilland and Errol Flynn, who had worked side by side for much of their professional careers up until this point. So Olivia de Havilland and Errol Flynn, my favorite on-screen pairing of actors, and the film that I consider their best with one another is They Died With Their Boots On. All right. And so the final top 10 list of the day is my top 10 favorite directors. So this one might have been the hardest. I actually probably moved people around the most on this list. I knew who the 10 were going to be. I did, but the order was a little tricky, but I think I finally got it in an order that I'm willing to stick with. So coming in at number 10, I have William Wyler. And for him, I had to put two films, The Heiress and Roman Holiday. So William Wyler, obviously most people probably immediately think Ben-Hur, but I immediately think The Heiress and Roman Holiday. And it depends on the day, which one of those springs to mind first. But the fact that he got an Oscar-worthy performance out of Olivia de Havilland, even though she would claim he didn't get it out of her, she gave it to him. And the fact that he also got an Oscar-worthy performance out of Audrey Hepburn, Audrey Hepburn won the Oscar for Roman Holiday. Olivia de Havilland won one of her Oscars for The Heiress. This man, he had a knack for working with great actors and ensuring that their greatness came across on screen. He made great, great pictures. He made grand pictures. And so at number 10, William Wyler. At number 9, I have Noah Baumbach. I love Noah Baumbach both as a screenwriter and as a director. He's so good at communicating the quiet intimacies of life. And he's so good at having a narrative thread that follows all the way through the film, but isn't woven so fully throughout that you feel like you're being coddled as an audience member. Like he expects his audience to be intelligent enough to remember the callback when he brings it back at the end. And I really enjoy that about him too. But the quiet intimacy, the strength of the quiet intimacies that he can communicate as a director, it always blows me away. And my favorite film of his is Frances Ha. I love Frances Ha. I'm really considering reevaluating my top 100 films of all time list because I really think that one needs to go in the top 5. Like, that's how much I love it. Don't hold me to that because I haven't fully reworked the list yet, but it's definitely top 10, probably top 5. And speaking of Frances Ha and Noah Baumbach, at number 8, I have Miss Greta Gerwig. I think Greta Gerwig, she's such an artist. She just, her artistic voice and her artistic vision is unlike anyone else that's currently working right now. And I'm so excited to see where her career goes from here. I listed Little Women as, I think I like Lady Bird as a film slightly better than Little Women. I don't know. It depends on the mood I'm in and the day, really. But I think that Lady Bird is a better exhibition for Greta Gerwig as a screenwriter, while Little Women is a better exhibition for Greta Gerwig as a director. And so her work as a director in Little Women just astounded me the first time I saw it. And I either saw it 3 or 4 times in theaters, and every single time I was like, wow, Greta Gerwig is just, she's so good. So, so good. So she's number 8. And number 7, I have Amos Gitai, who is an Israeli director who I really admire. And for him, I actually wrote down 2 films. So I have Metamorphosis of a Melody, which Runa Delkovets actually appears in. And then I have Free Zone, which I didn't just include Free Zone because Natalie Portman is in it. I think Free Zone has the greatest opening scene of all time. It's like an 8.5-minute scene of Natalie Portman's character weeping in the backseat of a taxi at the Wailing Wall while Ahad Gadgah plays. And it's so good. Now, the rest of the film is not as good as that opening scene. It pains me to admit. I wish that it was, because if it was, it would be one of my favorite films. But it's not. But I do like how inventive and experimental Amos Gitai is in Free Zone. He overlays a lot of sequences. So you see, like, these sprawling landscapes of the main characters driving in the taxi. And then laid over that, you have other images of, like, flashbacks from these characters and things, which I just think was a very interesting way of telling the story. So Metamorphosis of a Melody is probably better than Free Zone, but I think that Free Zone is indicative of just how experimental and interesting of an artist Amos Gitai could be. So he's at number 7. At number 6, I have Quentin Tarantino. I love Tarantino. There's not a single Tarantino film I don't like. He's an artist. He is one of the most talented people working today in the film industry. I love the way he crafts his screenplays. I love that he, you know, allows his scenes and his actors to breathe, that they feel, they're so lengthy, they feel realistic, they feel lived in. He takes his time with the scene. Not many filmmakers, I feel like, do that anymore. Obviously, quite a few on this list do. I gravitate towards those filmmakers. But a lot of your mainstream filmmakers, I feel like, don't allow their characters and the moments in their films to breathe the way that Tarantino does. I love, you know, the way he crafts just the visual nature of his film. I love his eye. I like Tarantino all around. Sorry if you don't, but I do. And my favorite Tarantino film, it's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It had been Inglourious Basterds for years, but then I saw Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is absolutely my favorite film from 2019. Probably my favorite film, well, never mind. I was going to say in the last 5 years, but then I got to thinking about all the movies that have come out in the last 5 years, and it maybe not. Jackie edges it out, probably, but I love Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's in my top 20 favorite films of all time. I think it might be like 12 or something like that, because I just really, really love that movie. And I, like I said, I love all Tarantino movies, but yes, it is 12, by the way. I just consulted my Letterboxd list, and Once Upon a Time in Hollywood is my 12th favorite film of all time. So, and Inglourious Basterds is in the 30s somewhere. So to have two films ranking that highly on my list of favorite films automatically puts Tarantino really high on my list of directors for me personally. And then at number 5, I have Pablo Larraín. I talked about Tarantino's eye. I love his eye for visuals. I love the way he structures his films. I love that he uses framing devices. I love, again, he lets his characters breathe. He gets in the mindset of his characters, which is something that not a lot of directors do. But he does. He's one of those directors who you feel like truly is involved to the most granular level in terms of making his film. And so I really like all of his films, but obviously I'm extremely biased, and my favorite film of Pablo Larraín's is Jackie. I love everything about Jackie. I think Jackie is listed as my favorite film on Letterboxd, and I think that all around, yeah, it is probably my favorite. And a lot of that, yes, Natalie Portman's performance is a reason for that, but Pablo Larraín's direction is just as compelling in terms of how much it contributes to that being my favorite film. Like, it contributes equally as Natalie Portman's performance. So that's a huge honor for me to say aloud. So yeah, Pablo Larraín, number 5. And then at number 4, I have Franco Zeffirelli. Listen, the 1968 Romeo and Juliet struck a chord in me so deeply when I was young. I saw it. It's another film that I saw my freshman year of high school in a classroom setting. But unlike A Streetcar Named Desire, I was transfixed by this film. It wasn't even just the performances, it was the film as a whole. Like, I loved it. And mainly I loved Olivia Hussey's performance as Juliet, that's what I was most struck by, even though I appreciated the film as a whole. But because of her performance, I considered that 1968 film version of Romeo and Juliet to be my second favorite film of all time for a really long time. It was Garden State, then Romeo and Juliet were my favorite films. And I watched it a lot, and the more I watch it, the more I've come to appreciate Zeffirelli's direction. It's just, man, it's beautiful. And he's done a lot of great, you know, adaptations. He did The Taming of the Shrew. He did Hamlet. I believe he did Othello. Getting Away from Shakespeare, I know he did Jane Eyre. But it's that Romeo and Juliet for me. I cannot tell you how much I love the 1968 Romeo and Juliet. And so for that reason alone, like even if he had made no other films, Zeffirelli really would be in my top 10. But when you take his, you know, entire directorial filmography into account, he comes in at number 4 on my list of favorite directors. And then number 3, I have George Cukor. I really enjoy George Cukor. I think that he, like a few other people on this list, is a director who pays really close attention to character. He does really good character studies and is able to communicate to actors in a way so that they truly give their best performance possible. I wanted to put Gone with the Wind down as my favorite George Cukor directed picture, even though he only directed a few scenes. I know that his direction is what most directly inspired Vivien Leigh's portrayal of Scarlett and Olivia de Havilland's portrayal of Melanie. You know, they turned to George Cukor over Victor Fleming with a lot of choices about their acting choices in the film. But actually my favorite George Cukor film that he directed in its entirety is My Fair Lady. I think that's a great exhibition of his skill as a director. I really enjoy that picture and I really enjoy his direction. And then on to number 2, I have Alfonso Cuarón. I think Alfonso Cuarón is the most talented director working today. I really do. I have thought that since I first saw Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban, which I think is the, without a doubt, the best Harry Potter film. It's not my favorite Harry Potter story. I enjoy Half-Blood Prince and Goblet of Fire. So Prisoner of Azkaban was not my favorite book. But it absolutely is the best movie. I mean, Alfonso Cuarón was able to elevate that film beyond just being an adaptation of a kid's book into being something truly special and truly cinematic, truly awe-inspiring. I love that film. But my favorite Alfonso Cuarón picture, honestly, is Roma. I think Roma was robbed of Best Picture. I really, really wanted it to win. But it's okay. It's okay. Again, the Academy, to me, is not the end-all be-all in terms of recognition of actual talent. But it's okay. Anyways, still very, very bitter about Green Book. But I think we all are, so that's fine. And then my favorite director of all time is none other than Mr. Mike Nichols. What can I say? I mean, Mike Nichols, to me, is the best that ever was in terms of motivating actors, getting performances out of actors, whether Olivia de Havilland, who never worked with Mike Nichols, to my knowledge, you know, she claimed that directors don't get performances out of performers, that the performers give the performances, but Mike Nichols got performances out of actors. Like, he's not just my favorite because of his contributions to Natalie Portman's overall career trajectory, but without him, I don't know that Natalie Portman would still be acting today. So obviously I do have a soft spot in my heart for him for that reason. You know, he got her working with a breathing coach. He got her to take herself seriously, which is something that she hadn't done up until that point. Now she was seriously talented and people recognize that, but he was the reason that she finally found that marriage between the innate natural talent and the studied professional approach to her craft. But I mean, come on, The Graduate, which I've already talked about how much I love that film earlier in this episode when I was talking about soundtracks, but you know, Silkwood, so good. Mike Nichols worked with Meryl Streep so many times and always got great performances out of her. Something that I dearly love Mike Nichols for is that he directed the filmed version of Gilda Live, which was Gilda Radner's one-woman comedy show. And I pop that DVD in all the time. Anytime I'm feeling sick or down, or anytime I'm happy and just want to be even more elated than I already am, I turn to Gilda Live. And you don't usually, you know, think of direction all that much when you're watching like a one-woman comedy show, but Mike Nichols, you feel his fingerprints even on Gilda Live. And that's something I love about him, that he was such a genius that even something where you should not even be mindful of the director it's not, he doesn't take it over at all, but you can feel his loving touch on it. I could go on and on. I think Mike Nichols is the greatest that ever was. I really, really do. I mean, his theater direction was phenomenal. When time travel is invented, I'm going back and watching his Shakespeare in the Park production of The Seagull. Absolutely. Heartburn, Biloxi Blues, The Birdcage, Charlie Wilson's War. Like, he just, Carnal Knowledge, Catch 22. Like, I can't think of a Mike Nichols movie that I don't enjoy. I really can't. And all of them, when I watch them, I'm like, oh, that's Mike Nichols. And then, of course, I have to mention Closer. Closer, it's not my favorite movie by a long shot, but I think it's one of the most well-executed films of all time. And that is thanks to Mike Nichols. So, yeah, I mean, he's my favorite director of all time. And so those are my top 10 lists. I promise that future special episodes will not be this long because I'll only be doing one list at a time. And maybe they won't be Kyla undiluted or Kyla all on her own. Maybe I'll be able to talk guests into coming on and keeping me in check. Maybe even they can make lists of their own. But I hope that you've enjoyed this. I hope that this has given you a little bit more of a sense of who I am as a film viewer. Hopefully you enjoyed me droning on and on for over 80 minutes. Maybe you didn't, but oh well. Please come back for the next episode when I'm talking about a specific film. So this has been Play It Again, Kyla, our first extra special episode within which I gave you my top 10 list of favorite actors, favorite film soundtracks, favorite pairings of actors, and favorite directors. As always, if you have suggestions of films you would like to hear discussed or top 10 lists you would like to hear discussed, don't hesitate to reach out. You can find me personally at @Kyla_Z_Percival on Instagram, Twitter, and Letterboxd. And you can find the podcast with the handle Play It Again Kyla on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. Once again, this has been Play It Again Kyla. I am your host, Kyla Percival, signing off and saying I voted for Andy Kaufman.
Remember this, a kiss is still a kiss, a sigh is just a sigh, the fundamental things apply as time goes by.